Is it really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline studio. Steve Bertrand on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in and welcome to Monday afternoon. Really, you know, we're sitting here on the 18th floor at 303 East Wacker above the Chicago River. And to our west, down the river, is the Wrigley Building. And this is one of those days. It's just a beautiful winter scene, really. The sun is so low in the sky and the shadows on the Wrigley Building. It's one of those views that you're not going to see very often. Got very distracted by that. But Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis are in the studio from Chicago. Inno, you both look over my shoulder. Look at it. Am I right?
Christmas in Chicago is the best. The shots from last night from the football game, I love when like Sunday Night Football shows up in Chicago during Christmas time and all the like great pictures of Michigan Ave and the river. Yeah, it's the best.
They did some nice sequences going down the river, but it is striking sort of it's almost a yellow light today. Okay, but that has nothing to do with business, technology, innovation, or any of that. Chicago Inno does. And Dahlke, you took in the Amazon Go store. Now, they've got three in Chicago now, right?
That's right.
The most recent one opened up yesterday?
So the most recent one was last week or the other week in Ogilvy Transportation Center, so at 500 West Madison, and had not done the Amazon Go thing yet. I know that they've been in Chicago for a few months now.
So it's a cashierless store, so it's going to be a real job killer around the country.
So, exactly. So,
but you
so,
just walk in, take your stuff, and leave?
So you download the Amazon Go app on your phone, and to get into the store, there's a little turnstile, so you scan the app when you go in.
So you got to be sort of registered.
Right, so you get the app, you get your payment information all in there, and then really all it is scan your phone on the turnstile and walk in. So then from there, you put your phone away and grab the things you want and leave. It is really that simple.
So when I was reading your story, and you got such a millennium sort of grocery cart filled with things. You had the Starbucks drink, Altoid mints, and a Cliff Bar.
That's right. Yeah. All you need to survive.
Is that breakfast?
A good deal on the Cliff Bars. I think you get one for $1.25
right,
there.
Yeah.
But what do? You bag them? If you're bagging, is there a bagging station or how does that work?
They have some bags in there. So I think you have to, for a small fee, you can take a bag out of there. Mm-hmm. But most people aren't really going there for the kind of trip that you even really need a bag, right? It is kind of a grab and go. Like you put a few things in your hands and you walk out. I kind of went into the experience a little skeptical, just because, for one, I don't want to necessarily give Amazon more of my money, more of my data.
Right.
So, but after using it, I think I'm like 100% bought into this.
Well, you mentioned in your story that it's a perfect spot at a train station. I don't take the train like I used to, but man, you're on the run sometimes, and it keeps you from buying something. If you can just go grab it and get out, it's golden.
You don't think that the line to pay for something is that big of a pain point until you're 2 minutes away from your train leaving.
Right.
So really, like, the amount of time that it saves, especially at a place like a train station, is a really big deal.
Catherine, you've got all the time in the world. Does this sound attractive to you?
Yeah, well, actually, Amazon, Reuters reported last week that they're looking at putting these Amazon Go stores in airports. And I'm like, just like the train station, that's an ideal place to put one. You're in a time crunch. You got to catch a flight. You don't have time to wait in the line at Hudson News or wherever.
So if you walk in the store without the – can you walk in the store without the app?
So you have to download the app to actually get into the turnstile.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. So if I was going with you, could
I could scan you in.
You could scan me in.
I could scan you in. And so the tech, so it's really impressive. So they've got all these sensors and cameras pretty much all over the ceiling, and it's capturing when you can pick something up, and it actually knows when you put something back. So if I picked up that tin of Altoids and then put it back, it wouldn't charge me.
You went for Wintergreen instead of Peppermint.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you walk out, just a few minutes later after you leave the store, it actually sends you a receipt to the Amazon Go app showing you how long you were in the store, everything you bought, and the price.
And they want to open 3,000 of these around the country.
That's the reported story. So yeah, I think that was Bloomberg just several weeks ago said that Amazon really has a plan to kind of blow these up. And Chicago, interestingly enough, has been one of its pilot cities. It's pretty much only available here in Seattle. And then I think there's one store in San Francisco.
So on Saturdays when I'm a little hungry, I like to go to the Whole Foods and eat their samples. And Amazon owns Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. Will one day I be able to get my $3.25 macaroon at Whole Foods and walk out?
Boy, you sure think so. It's a lot harder and a bigger scale. The last thing I read is that Amazon is kind of testing this on kind of like a bigger, larger store format. It's much simpler to do kind of the convenience store model. It gets a little trickier when there's 200 items in your cart and you're traveling through a much bigger store, you have to multiply the number of sensors and cameras they have in this small little store times, you know, times 10, times 20.
So what's the factor then? I mean, there would be theft, I would imagine, but they just figure the money we're saving on employees, we can afford to lose in theft?
I mean, perhaps, you know, it's an interesting model because, you know, a lot of people are like, well, we're like losing, you know, workers. Like this is, you know, ruining jobs at, you know, Amazon Go stores, of course, and then Whole Foods, if they eventually are able to expand this tech there in the future.
Right.
But I guess we'll just have to see.
I'm whining about the jobs, and I mean it, but of course it's progress, and that's what we do too.
Right, but it's also opening up different jobs, right? Someone needs to maintain the system of sensors and cameras, right? Someone has to greet the customer. It's not like that eliminates jobs completely. You go to the one at Ogilvy, and there's several people out there greeting people as they come in, showing them how to download the app, meeting with them, like walking them through the process. There's people inside helping you kind of navigate the aisle. So it's not like it's a total job eliminator.
It's like training the cat to feed themselves, though. Eventually, they won't be needed.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Catherine, you wrote about cryptocurrency and a startup in Chicago, and it seems like cryptocurrency was really hot for a while and then it went away, but you're making the point that it's really not gone away at all.
Yeah, so a Chicago startup here, ErisX, they raised $27.5 million last week from, you know, big people in the financial space like Fidelity Investments and NASDAQ Ventures. And, you know, basically they make a platform like many other companies where you can, you know, trade and deposit Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies.
Are they up and running? Are they still need approval?
So they're building their platform right now, and they expect it, you know, pending approval, that it'll be available in the next.
And was the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, was that a passing fancy when it comes to investors, or is that going to be around for the long haul?
I mean, to me, it feels like, you know, on a national scale, the interest has certainly died down and slowed. But I mean, the people who the financial institutions are still very much interested in where the future of this technology goes. And you're seeing that now. So this round was, I think, $27.5 million, which is pretty significant for a Chicago startup, and especially in the crypto space. So it seems like maybe national interest is sort of waning as the price of Bitcoin sort of falls. But as, you know, as a currency, as just an underlying technology, it's very interesting.
And I was just talking about that picture of the Wrigley building. I posted it on Facebook, so follow me there and you can see what I'm talking about. Put it up on Instagram in just a few minutes too. Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis are in the studio from Chicago Inno. Of course, they are the people behind the Inno Minute. Every morning on the opening bell with Steve Grzanich, you can hear it at 525 on 720 WGN. All right, Catherine, did you write this story about Walgreens? Was that you or Dahlke?
That was Jim, but...
Tell me about it anyway. So I did see this last week because it's kind of exciting, the idea that, you know, Walgreens is partnering with FedEx, mm-hmm. so that FedEx will end up bringing your prescription drugs to your house?
Exactly. So, you know, to kind of compete with Amazon and then also CVS, who recently rolled out their own prescription delivery service, Walgreens is partnering with FedEx to get you your prescriptions the very next day. So, you know, I think this is just kind of part of a trend of people want things right now. This on-demand model continues to dominate everything, and here it is at Walgreens.
And you don't want to go drive the 6 blocks or 2 miles or whatever it is to get to Walgreens, so just make FedEx bring it to you.
Exactly.
Now, I had always heard that Walgreens' model was that they sold stuff in order to get you to buy their drugs there because that's where the money was. I don't know if that's true, but if we go to all prescription or mail order prescriptions, what would that mean for the future of Walgreens stores?
Well, I think part of this is making sure that, you know, they don't lose customers to Amazon and CVS, right? So, I mean, there are going to be a certain segment of the population that would prefer to do this, right? So they don't want to lose market share to Amazon, right? So what's interesting, too, so Amazon bought a startup in June called PillPack, based up in Boston, for like around $1 billion, but still hasn't rolled out that pill delivery yet.
So I was going to say, when it comes to Amazon and healthcare, it's all sort of us thinking of the Mueller report, right? we get little dribs and drabs, but we don't really know what's going on there.
Right. And so what Walgreens, I think, sort of smartly has done is sort of, you know, get ahead of it, right? So even though the news was about Amazon previously, what they're doing is actually putting this into practice, right? So this is available nationwide, partnering. So basically for a $5 fee, you can get your prescription the next day.
I was wondering too, though, I would, like, some prescriptions are more tightly controlled than others, right? So I suspect that it wouldn't work for every prescription. Like if you're getting codeine or something like that, you probably have to show up.
Right. So this service called Walgreens Express also is going to have a dedicated counter in store. So you can get the mobile alert that says, hey, your prescription is ready. And there may be an option just to go in store. So what they do have is sort of like an easy way to get your medicine even at the store.
Good idea for FedEx, I would imagine, too. Pick up another customer base. Would the drugs be coming from the local store? Did you report into it that far?
I believe it's going to be on the local level, which is why you can make the option to either get it delivered or go to the
store. So in the morning, the FedEx truck would show up to the Walgreens, pick up the medicine from that store,
and bring it to your house.
Interesting. Okay, let's talk about Braintree. $500 billion in payments they've collected. Is that Venmo?
Yes. Okay. So, it's kind of a little or a lesser known Chicago tech story, but Venmo, the service that everybody uses all the time, it's, in this PayPal family, but it was actually bought by Chicago startup Braintree before PayPal even owned the company.
Okay.
So it was a really significant acquisition, I think back in 2012 when Braintree bought Venmo. So Braintree is basically kind of the underlying technology that allows your mobile transactions to take place. So think about when you step out of an Uber and the payment sort of happens sort of seamlessly to your phone. Braintree is the tech that powers that.
I see. Okay.
So in 2018.
So this is one of those Chicago B2Bs that we talked about.
Right. So in 2013, Braintree got bought by PayPal for $800 million. Great big headline in the Chicago tech and business world. And just this month, they announced that after 5 years from the acquisition, they've surpassed $500 billion in payment volume,
wow,
which is up from $50 billion just 3 years ago.
So we put that, Catherine, in the Chicago success story column.
Yeah, absolutely. And, the interesting thing about this acquisition is that, oftentimes when a company's acquired, it gets folded into its parent company, right? And its successes kind of just become its
parent company's successes.
But, this is interesting because, Braintree is still in a lot of ways kind of operating on its own with its own milestones. And, this is an example of that.
That's Catherine Davis, Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno. You can read more at chicagoinno.com. And tell me about the newsletter.
Yeah, The Beat is our daily email newsletter. You go to chicagoinno.com and you can sign up for it right from our homepage.
Nice to see you guys. Enjoy the walk back to the office.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand in the Allstate Skyline Studio, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. All right, in the studio now is Frank Ruffalo, who is the guy behind Franco's Ristorante in Bridgeport, and they just keep getting bigger and bigger. He's expanding. Welcome to the Business Lunch, Frank.
Thanks for having me.
All right, tell me about business. Tell me about, because you are a young man.
I am.
You took your dad built Franco's?
Yes, it was my dad's first sit-down restaurant.
Okay.
He had a couple beef stands and hot dog restaurants before that. He started this in 1987, and when I graduated college, I kind of took this over and revamped it, put my spin on it, and
Did you kick him out, or was it a willing thing?
It was a willing thing. They didn't willingly want me in the restaurant industry.
No dad or mother does, and they're both
in it, so I took that decision on my own, but then they were more than supportive with me remodeling.
And Franco's has been around since the mid-80s,
yes,
right?
Like 87 he started that.
And so you come in there, and you gut the place.
Yes, sir.
Was there resistance to that in the neighborhood? I mean, Reggie, if you're going to a place for 30 years and your joint sort of gets changed around.
We kept the food. We kept the heart of the restaurant the same. But now when you come in to enjoy that food, you're going to be in a much livelier, a brightened up, fresher restaurant that people have been taking it very well.
It's been a couple of years?
We've been open since April 2016, since the renovation.
And how is business there?
Great. Doing very well.
One of four or five?
The location we're doing is going to be our fifth location.
The fifth one, okay. Yes. And that is in this McCormick Square neighborhood.
McCormick Square.
Tell me about opening up tell me about, you've got one in Beverly.
Yes, we have one in Beverly called Francanello's.
Okay.
That's been there since 93.
One on the north side.
Yep, that's Jam and Honey. That's in Lincoln Park.
And what's that about? What are you doing up on the north
side? We saw the location. We liked it. We saw what was going to go well. We are directly across the street from St. Vincent de Paul.
Oh, no kidding.
So we have...
That's exactly where I lived. Where are you specifically?
We're on Webster and Sheffield. We're on the northeast corner.
The northeast corner. Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah. I used to go to a health club on the southeast corner, the Webster Fitness Center.
Yep, there you go.
Yeah.
So we thought, why not give them a good breakfast and lunch place to go to? And then we have another location.
That's kind of treasured ground. That's where Ina's Kitchen was.
Yes, Ina's was over there. She's been in quite a few times, so we got her blessing on that, I believe.
Oh, good.
We have that one, and then we have one at Buckingham Fountain, which is Franco's at the Fountain.
All right, so tell me about moving into McCormick Place, because this... It seems to me like, I mean, clearly you're successful, but this is a bigger venture.
It is a bigger venture. It's also a bigger location. We have a lot of customers from the South Loop already. They've always been asking, when are we coming there? It's always been, you know, a very scarce food and restaurant place around there.
Yeah.
So that's why we do get a decent crowd at our other restaurants. We always watch up-and-coming areas. We saw the development that was going on in the surrounding areas between the hotels, the Wintrust Arena. We saw a location, we fell in love with it, and went from there.
You know, it's an interesting thing, because I got to tell you, Frank, I haven't been down there yet. It's kind of like a pop-up neighborhood, right?
Yeah, it's really is up-and-coming. People don't see it, how big of a drastic change it's made. Some history behind it, there used to be a lot of car dealerships around there. The building I'm actually going into was the old Lexington Hotel.
Okay.
So that was Al Capone's
right,
hangout.
Yeah.
So that's where Geraldo Rivera.
We've all seen, maybe before you were born.
Yes, it was.
Okay, you didn't have to agree so quickly.
It's okay.
But we've all seen your building on TV then.
Yep. It was razed in about 1995, so they just demoed
it. They rebuilt it. Okay.
It's a 35-story called the Arrive Lex Tower. But that's where Geraldo Rivera did his big special, so I'm sure many people have seen the area it's going into. But now if you took a ride down there, you wouldn't recognize it.
And the restaurant is called Il Culacino?
Il Culacino. So that means the mark left by a cold wine glass.
Well, everyone knows that.
Well, absolutely. Obvious, right? I assume so, yeah.
Right.
So we want to make people feel comfortable, let them come in, enjoy themselves, and, you know, make their mark on the restaurant.
Okay, so this is a business show.
Yes.
Although we'll be happy to eat whatever food you brought in.
Of course.
When you're opening up a new restaurant or you're charting, it seems to me like this might be a little different than others because this one might be location driven.
Yes. So you have the audience here already. You have four hotels that recently went up, the Marriott Marquis, a couple of nice Hampton Inn, Hilton, and you have McCormick Place. So what we want to do is we want to cater to those people coming in. You know, every year they come in for a show, we want to be a part of their Chicago, you know, experience. But we want to get the neighborhood people also because they're the ones who have been asking for a great place to come and eat.
Well, so two things. First of all, it's not an island, but it is a bit distant.
A little
bit. So people who aren't going to want to go far from their hotel, it's going to be a great choice.
Right there, yeah.
But our conventions don't last forever, and so you're going to have to need to build a neighborhood clientele.
So
how do you do the balance of the two of those?
Whenever we go and start a new location, we want to be a part of that community. I think that's the reason why we've lasted so long in our locations, because we want them to know us as our neighborhood place where they can have their special occasions, you know, whatever fundraisers or whatever else they're planning on doing. We want to make sure we can cater to them and they feel welcome in our establishment. So with this, you know, there's a couple great schools going up there. There's a Goddard School. There's a ton of young families in the South Loop. So for them to come in walking distance in a place that they can have a good meal, we're going to do a really great patio outside so they can come and enjoy the weather when it's appropriate.
So it looks cool. You got the patio. It's a retractable patio,
yep.
Bigger space. I'm interested. I read it in an article, and maybe it's changed by now, but you're working on the hardscape of it.
Sure.
But you don't have the menu set yet.
So we do have the menu set, but we always like to keep that close to the vest until we are ready to open.
Well,
we like to work all that out
a little bit. Give me a little.
We're going to have a lot of classic Italian dishes, so
okay.
People are definitely going to feel comfortable with it. But we also want to do some Italian style tapas.
How old are you?
How old do you think I am?
I'm going to say you're 30 years old.
25.
25. Wow. I was trying to be generous. Okay.
Thank you.
So, do the old guys in the business ever give you a hard time?
No, I think they realize how difficult it is and how brutal of a business this is. So they kind of say, hey, you know what? Get out while you're young. But, you know, we've been around so long. We have a ton of friends that you all come up with each other and you enjoy the camaraderie.
What's your favorite part?
The favorite part is when someone can come in, and if I don't know you from Adam and you just come in, this was your first time, and you walk out and say, hey, it's such a great experience. I can't wait to come back, because that's what we're all about, is having a good time, and we want to, you know, become friends with you.
The name of the restaurant is Il Culacino, and it will be open this spring?
Yes, early spring. That's what we're hoping for.
Well, listen, I wish you great luck.
Thank you.
It was nice to talk to you. Clearly, you are successful at the ripe old age of 25.
Thank you.
I hope it only continues to grow.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. Thanks for having me.
Is there a website or somewhere where people
there
can
is. It's ilculacino.com. We're also on social media, on Facebook and Instagram, so you can
Il
find
Culacino,
us everywhere.
Ilculacino, right, and that's the common spelling.
Exactly. Real simple. So it's ILCULACCINO.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. We all know that data is invaluable to companies and customers, but you may not be utilizing it in the best way. That's why 1871 is hosting a data jumpstart event to take you from to oh yeah.
when it comes to Excel and data analytics. Even just the little things about efficiency and new methods are vital to the way a company can boost their operations. The event is at 1871 on Wednesday, December 12th at 6:30 p.m. in their 1871 Quaker Conference Room. Help yourself and your company by registering at 1871.com. And we're in the thick of the holiday shopping season. What better way to feel good about the gifts you're giving than to do product research from the people who make products themselves? The great minds over at MHub have gathered up some of their favorite consumer products of the year, and they reviewed those products for you to check out at MHub.com. That way, when your loved ones open up their gift, they won't have to fake that smile we all hate to break out this time of year. You're welcome. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
It's 12:51. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. On the phone line now is Elise Glink from thinklink.com and Best Money Moves. She joins us on most Mondays, at least when we're lucky or so. Elise, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Nice to be here today.
So I said before the show started and teased talking to Jane Pete, I said, you know why millennials don't spend as much money is because they don't have as much money. And that sort of was the result of a Fed study, or was the conclusion of a Fed study, right? We worry about all of the things that the millennials are doing to the economy, but maybe it's what the economy has done to the millennials.
Well, it's really hard, right? I mean, millennials are now, the oldest of them are turning 40, and they are well into their lives, and we keep hearing about how if they would just eat fewer avocados, they would be able to buy houses and start, you know, their married lives and whatever it's going to be. But it turns out that the Federal Reserve thinks it's not having enough to spend is really the problem. And that's something you and I have talked about before.
So just for point of reference, the article that we're working from, or the one I'm looking at, says millennials roughly were born between 1981 and 1997. So does this mean that because that they were the generation hit hardest by the Great Recession? Is that what we're talking about?
It's a lot of it, right? So going into the Great Recession, you had people who were coming out of college and suddenly there were no jobs, right? So, think back to where we were in 2008 and 2009, and even the beginning in some parts of the country of 2007, people were graduating and there were just no jobs at all, and there were loads of graduates. And so they couldn't get jobs, they took anything that they could get. And in fact, if you look at some of the studies that came out, you know, 4, 5, 6 years after the recession ended, millennials were still suffering and in fact had changed what they were doing and what their aspirations were. And now a decade later, we're seeing that they still haven't caught up to where they would have been had they been in even a mediocre economy when they came out instead of terrible.
And if they were as they're young and up and coming, they probably are less able to absorb increases in costs. I mean, the Kaiser Foundation says that in 2006, the average deductible for an employer-sponsored health care plan was $303. That's just 12 years ago. Last year, it was over $1,500. So workers are being expected to pay a lot more.
Well, right. These high deductible health care plans, a decade ago, only 7% of employers had them. Today, 75% of employers are offering high deductible health care plans where the employer is on the hook for maybe $1,500, but in a lot of cases it could be $1,500 per person in your family.
Right, yeah.
So multiply that times 4 and you're suddenly looking at, wow, I'm on the hook for the first $6,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 depending on the plan that you choose. And that's a lot for people to come up with.
And the real thing, and I think the biggest thing is we're more educated. Everyone's getting a degree. Unfortunately, sometimes we're forced to get a degree for a job for which there really aren't requirements for degrees. But compared to college tuition in 1988, private school tuition in 2018 increased 213%. If you went to a four-year public school, it was up 129%. There's just been this explosive growth in the cost of a college degree, and it's hard to overcome that.
It is, especially when real incomes have barely budged in 25 years. So we have seen some improvement over the last year or two, and you might hear that incomes are up, 3% over last year, and you think to yourself, well, that's quite an improvement. But also, inflation is up. So if inflation is up 2 or 2.5% and real incomes are up 3%, the net income growth is only 0.5%. And that even is something better than what we've seen over the last 20 years, because really it didn't move at all over 20 years, well under the rate of inflation. And so what happened is the buying power was so much less, and millennials have kind of borne the brunt of that.
And if you are a parent of a millennial and you are still handing out money to your kids, I don't know if you should feel like you're helping or enabling, but Country Financial did a study. They said most American adults between the ages of 21 and 37, a majority of them, are still getting some sort of financial assistance from their parents. That then reaches into their parents' generation and has an impact on them.
It does. And so what we're seeing is that for even the oldest of millennials, the 37, 38-year-olds, you know, their parents might be in their late 50s, early 60s. And we're also seeing next year the retirement age jump. Those people had simply not been able to pay off their own college tuition debts. They're paying off their kids' college tuition debts. They haven't really saved enough for retirement. They may have taken a big hit that they never recovered from in the Great Recession. And so we've got a generation of baby boomers, the parents of the millennials, who are now getting ready to enter retirement, the least prepared of any generation.
Wow.
So we've got a multi-generation issue coming up in terms of affordability on the young side with millennials today and Gen Z behind them, and then their parents, the baby boomers, on the upper end.
So I guess the lesson from the show, if you take anything away from this, is the next time you see a millennial ordering an avocado toast at a restaurant, don't scoff, maybe offer to pay for it.
Exactly. That's what we need.
Check out more at thinklink.com. Nice to talk to you today. I appreciate it.
You too, Steve. Take care.